then it became a majority white city. And 2 years later, Jim Crow was instituted, and there was not another black person elected from the state of North Carolina till 1992.
Wow. It is an amazing film, and I encourage people to watch it. It premieres tonight on PBS and also live streams. Yoruba Richens, co-director of American Coup, Wilmington, 1898. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This is Democracy Now!
Puberty is when you grow into your adult body, usually between 8 and 14 years old. All that growing brings changes that may make you feel scared, confused, excited, or all of the above. It's all good. You're just maturing. Puberty is a process that lasts years, hits differently for everybody, and can last till you're around 20. So how do the changes show up? You may get pimples, mostly on your face, but on your body too. Hair. The hair you have on your arms and legs may get thicker and darker, and you'll likely grow hair in new places, like your face, armpits, chest, and pubic area. Stretch marks are common too, a sign of your adult body taking shape. Physical changes, from body odor to growth spurts, are just part of the puberty story. All kinds of new feelings may come on, too, like crushes and being sexually turned on. It's super common to feel like your emotions suddenly turn on and off, sad, angry, or irritated. No matter how you're feeling about all these changes to your body, remember that puberty is a normal part of growing up, and knowing what to expect can help to make it feel a lot less weird or stressful. Want to learn more? Go to PlannedParenthood.org/teens.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB in Stony Brook, broadcasting at 90.1 FM and 107.3 FM, as well as over the internet at WUSB.FM. The time is 6 o'clock on a Tuesday, which means it's time once again for another edition of Off the Wall. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yeah.
And, well, you know, we got some things to talk about tonight for sure. But before we launch into any of that, let's get rid of the old theme there. Let's fade that down gracefully. And let's start up a new theme. Yes, it's the final edition, I guess, because we're out of films. The feature is Films of the Year That Was, where we see Academy Award winning films from the beginning of time to the end of time. And we're at the latter now, so we have seen the winning international film. There's two winning films every year, the American film and Everybody Else. And we saw the winning international film of 2023. Did we not, Kyle?
We did. Zone of Interest.
The Zone of Interest. Now, this is about a German family who lives in a wonderful house with their five kids, and they have a bunch of servants. And it's basically about the struggle of the wife to hold on to the house after the husband is transferred to a better job. Did I miss anything?
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, I missed the entire Holocaust, didn't I?
Yeah, you basically missed a lot. But you also characterized it somewhat eloquently.
I try to see the positive. Yeah, you know, that's what I'm trying to do.
Correct, I guess, or something. No, so it's through the lens of the people in charge of this camp, right? And
Auschwitz.
Yes. And they're the space and the lifestyle is very plain. It's almost boring. It's matter of fact.
Mm.
There's an order to keep up the household and to keep up appearances. And as you are woven into their daily lives and you see these little breaks, little instances, little hints of horror.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also, of course, the sound design and the background. And it's their, I think, routinity around the background and ignoring it and their silence amidst it as though it is totally normal. That's haunting. And that really starts emerging. And there's also three sections of tones or colors where you hear like a disorienting rumble or a sound escape, and the screen goes to a color or dark. It starts black. There's another section of white and then red, which I realize is the color of the flag of the Nazi Party at the time. But also just the sort of metaphor in so much of the imagery and so much of the starkness and sort of liminality. You get the industrialization, the industrial feel of what they're around, and how that seeps into their life and their orderliness and indifference and really detachment.
Well, it's interesting because what do you say? Yeah, definitely, it resonates. It's basically about a family who lives right smack next door to the Auschwitz concentration camp in Poland. The father, Rudolf, this is interesting, Rudolf Haas is not the same as Rudolf Hess. Rudolf Hess was a close confidant of Adolf Hitler, and this guy ran the Auschwitz camp. They lived right next door. His whole family was there, and it's weird because you don't actually see any of the horror. You see the buildings in the background over the fence. You see infernos, fires, bodies being burned, all kinds of nightmares like that. But you don't ever see anything. You just are aware of it in the background. I think the way it's described, it's almost like another film is playing at the same time as this film, which is incredible. I really did get immersed in it. It's a fascinating and true story they actually did live next door to a concentration camp. It's pretty sickening when you think bringing kids up in that environment, all the things that the family was receiving, these were all things that were taken from the people who were killed, shoes and clothing and just insane amounts of things were just stolen from these people as they were being murdered. There was this one girl who I believe was a servant. There were local Polish people who were servants to the Nazis, not by choice. And she would sneak out at night and drop food off for the prisoners who had worked during the day. She'd ride her bicycle and leave apples in various places. Now, the way this was done, and I read the description of it, they had a problem because, well, there were no street lights. She didn't have a light on her bike. How do you film this? And they went with what's the film technique they used?
Infrared.
And I think they used a couple of like surveillance camera type things to capture.
This
that.
Is a lot better than that, I think.
Yeah.
Although those are increasing in quality, no doubt because of their use in conflict, but. There are large format systems that are provided by specific companies that specialize in this, and it was very artfully done, and I think that's exactly what it conveys, is that what you're seeing is in complete darkness. The heat map of just a human in darkness, and showing the tones and shading through the use of heat, mm-hmm. instead of light, and that I think it also has sort of a coldness.
Yes.
When you see that used in conflict, it's usually with some grim telemetry or photography, but this in an artful way also conveys that this heat, this only bit of warmth, is going on in total darkness, in the cold.
Wow.
And that is exactly what she's doing. She's placing apples. And the apples are also, and little gifts like that, are seen in other moments when protagonists are just going from one place to another. You just get a glance and a little bit of a hint at that, having been part of that action, that it's overlooked in the daytime. It's not seen, something they're aware of. So it's your attitude and you're in on it, having seen the dark photography.
It threw me for a loop because, you know, in the middle of this film, which is really stark and taking place in the Nazi era, all of a sudden here you are looking at infrared, spying on somebody on a bicycle. So it kind of threw me, but I guess that was the point, to show what else was happening there.
Well, and it weirdly shows you black and white imagery, which a lot of our sense of the time is black and white. Color was emerging, or was, you know, not as widely used in documenting that era and the periods before it. So. I think it has it's a nod to that as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's again, just as the Best Picture winner Oppenheimer had a lot of black and white. This is similar, but it is instead tuned for the heat. And it was sort of a fusion of modern and also, like I said, a nod to archival photography of the era.
I just realized both of the winners this year were of the same era, taking place at about the same time. So that was something. But getting back to the film itself and the style that they had, I was a little bit annoyed at the beginning because there was just this music that went on for about 2 minutes, more than 2 minutes, without any picture. And, you know, I'm not sure if it was setting the mood or what. You know, they used to have entry music for movies where everybody would be finding their seats and they'd be playing some kind of theme, you know, over the speakers, but there'd be nothing on the screen. I didn't really see the point of that. It just, I wanted to get into the story and, you know, I was already in the mood for the story, so I didn't need 2 minutes of blank screen for that.
It faded. It faded from some kind of revelry or music, but then it became birds, and then it cut to them swimming.
Right.
And it was a scene of outdoors and summertime and like
right. No, you saw my mood change when I heard the birds. My mood changed because I said, "Okay, the film's about to start now." I've been sitting here for a while.
There were some daring choices. I mean, that's an odd fusion, but I think it's also, if I'm reading into it, I mean, this is, you know,
you're supposed to. That's why we're here.
Cinema theory 404, Kyle. Mm-hmm. But I think like it's just the juxtaposition, the contrast of darkness with something going on in opposition or in on the other side of something, right? Like, even though you can't see anything, you're hearing a totally different or like I guess inverse type of scene, right? Like, you're not seeing anything, or you're not hearing it. You might see something visual in the inverse. So something like that might be kind of hinting at these odd, this home life that's so beautiful with all these flowers that are keeping up, and the whole life is about keeping up this appearance of a home and this way of rationalizing that if you have that, if that's okay, the family, the home life is okay, then there's nothing else the matter. And I found, I mean, that to me speaks to some of the moments we're going to be experiencing, the moments we're in now. I'll leave it at that. But it is that strange need. It's a sort of like an obsession, a way of regaining some control in a moment that is wildly out of control. Everything is out of control around you. And that sort of like compulsion to maintain some kind of enclave. And the irony and the horror of this is that, you know, a lot of the flowers in the garden that were so beautiful, a lot of that stood in contrast to it. And it was this sort of oasis, and it was maintained by slave labor. And I mean, they're like pouring ash in the soil. I mean, it was really just so much depth to what they're trying to invoke.
Well, it was done in and almost documentary style, because you didn't really feel much emotion. You didn't really feel like you were seeing something from the perspective of a particular person. You were there. You were in the garden. You were watching what people were doing. And the continuity was perfect. I don't think I've seen films like this very often where, you know what I mean, where somebody is walking in a particular way, then you switch angles, and is that person still there in the same place? Yes, in every case.
What do you think about the dog?
Whoever played the dog was absolutely phenomenal. What am I saying? Obviously, it's a dog. that particular dog, though, which happened to be the dog of the wife in real life, the person that played the wife, that dog is incredible. It just was injected itself into various scenes, but did so in a way that was not ego driven, if you know what I mean. Basically, he would steal things off the table at just the right moment. And that's another thing, the continuity, another long shot. And you saw the dog was still stealing something off the table. And that's right. The dog understood continuity. At times, though, there was a little bit too much of him, but, you know, he was one of my favorite characters. I was very impressed by that. You mentioned the flowers, the lilacs in particular. There was one scene, and this was so ridiculous, where he's dictating, Rudolf Hess is dictating a memorandum on the telephone. And he's basically chastising other SS personnel, basically chastising them for picking lilacs in the wrong manner, which hurts the plant, causes the plant to bleed, actually. And I don't doubt that such a thing actually happened, where an SS guy, you know, one of the head SS guys, gets all bent out of shape because somebody's picking flowers wrong. And that basically shows you how they completely dehumanized the people on the other side of the fence, if you needed any more convincing of that. It struck you in ways you weren't expecting it to strike you. So for that, I really thought it did a phenomenal job. But again, at the end, they did the same thing with the music. You know, maybe I'm just thick, but I'm going to ruin it if you haven't seen it. He's in a different city. And it's kind of hard sometimes to know which city he was in because he's in a building and, okay, are you by Auschwitz or is other city he got transferred to? Okay, so he's in the other city and he's walking downstairs and he starts gagging and we don't know why. And he keeps walking downstairs and he keeps gagging. And then all of a sudden we switch to modern day where there is maintenance staff cleaning up the museum at Auschwitz. Is that right? And okay, and then blank screen, music for another minute and a half, and credits. I don't know what that was supposed to mean. I mean, yeah, I get the mood, I get the feeling, but why was he gagging? Was he rebelling against this somehow? Because in real life, I don't think he did that. It was weird. I thought it was a good film. I enjoyed it, but there were parts that it just seemed like it was kind of a film project, you know, where they were showing off things and making it, you interpret it your own way, and I didn't know how to interpret that. I wanted to know what happened to the bastard, what happened to, you know, his family. I wanted to see Liberation Day. I know not every film is going to do that, but I don't know. I just didn't want to be sitting there for a minute and a half wondering, is it over, and having to wait for the credits to, you know, confirm that it was.
Wait a minute. Okay. I mean, I understand. I mean, I'll read into it to a certain degree. I was willing to go there, but I like thinking about what you're saying and then thinking about like a space odyssey or something. And then, okay, so that ended strange and we're not complaining about that. We're all often citing it. So what is so strange about this?
People did complain about that though. They did.
Okay. So maybe it's on that level. I gave it benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to me, him creating a mess on the floor did sort of tie in with the cut to the museum itself, which was interesting and a bit jarring, made it feel a little like documentary. But if you're along for the ride, you go there, and we'd actually visited this site. So it was, to me, this idea that it is maintained now for a very different purpose.
Yes, but
and that he was creating a mess. And that was, and I think what it was an allusion to is the, and what I felt it was an allusion to is the extent to which, if at all, anyone in those positions ever thought of or took on in any slight amount of empathy what their work was from a sort of perspective or distance or a wider view, bigger picture, that was about it. As they descended into darkness. And I mean, that's simple and as much as I think what you observed, but they just, I think, picked a certain way to do it. And to say that this site is real, there are, and it is.
Yes, but my point is, it's a different site. He was descending into darkness, which is, you know, that's great right there. That imagery, that works for me. But he's descending into darkness in a building in a different country. And then they switched to modern day Auschwitz and the museum. That's kind of threw me, because at least show some continuity between. Yeah, you see, you thought he was in Auschwitz too. I thought that. You didn't?
No, I know he was still traveling, but he was in communication to his connection,
right.
And invariably, inextricably, he is connected to that site in so far even as his significant other, his wife, his partner, is maintaining it,
mm-hmm.
and his approval of facilities there and expanding from the early moments in the film, going through in analytical ways about the logistics and
the
metrics.
The conversation that you're having with contractors about how to build an incinerator.
Talking about people in terms of loads and stuff. I mean,
they called people loads. That's what they called them. That hit me like
very intentional, and I think that those were his accomplishments. So, yeah, he could be in Berlin and descending back down into darkness to what? Get back there. So, I don't know. It is perhaps done in an unusual way.
Okay, I guess it works because it's got us talking about it. It's got us thinking about it. So, that's the important thing. The Zone of Interest, directed by Jonathan Glazer. It's a British film, actually. You might think it's a German film, but it's actually a British film. Any closing thoughts on this, Kyle, before we play the closing theme? For the last time until the next set of films?
I'm interested in what stories are being told internationally. I don't know. I like the spareness of it. The sort of, I said, liminal nature of a lot of it. But the photography...
Starkness, too.
The photography, the close-ups... really helped with hinting at a lot of the little details pushed a lot of you trying to piece things together, and I think helped with the perspective they're telling the story from. It helped move it along to give you guide you a little bit in drawing meanings as you moved through the stories.
Just unplug it now. Okay, well, that's it. We're done with films of the year that was, because there's no more films. We caught up. We've never caught up before, I don't think. I guess we did last year. All right, but we're caught up now, and we will, you know, maybe next year we'll do it again. Zone of Interest.
If we win.
We win what?
If we make a film.
Uh-huh.
If one of our YouTube videos or something like becomes like Best Picture, then do we review our own Best Picture?
No, I don't think that would be appropriate. I don't think we should be reviewing our own film.
Okay.
I don't think that's right.
We just like have a lottery about like who comments.
You know, we gotta dive into this, Kyle. We gotta dive into the elephant that won't get out of the room. All right, look. Here's how I wanna frame this. All right. We finally got Marco Rubio out of the House of Representatives. Okay? I'm sorry, out of the Senate. My God, he's a senator. Not anymore. Not anymore. Yeah. Stefanik, she's out too. Yeah. All these people are gone as a result of the election. Unfortunately, it's not for the reason that we would have preferred. It's because... Trump won. He won the election, and now he's appointing people left and right. And, you know, every day it's like another nightmare. Oh, my God, really? You're appointing this person? You know, I'm making, you know how The Simpsons made a joke about President Trump long before he ever was considered seriously actually running for president? Well, I've been making jokes saying, oh, yeah, Marjorie Taylor Greene is the new Secretary of State. And I realized I should stop because... that tends to happen. When you say it out loud, somehow there are forces that make that reality.
No, you make things real with language, E, and yeah. I've been telling you to stop for like at least half a dozen years now.
People have been telling me to shut up for a long time, and I'm starting to listen now.
I think you should listen.
All right, we don't have
more.
To belabor the point, but okay. Envoy to Israel, Mike Huckabee, that was announced today. Lee Zeldin, head of the EPA. Oh my God. Okay, you know, we witnessed him firsthand as one of the most inept and horrible people, but mostly a climate denier, climate change denier, heading the EPA. Oh, how's that going to go? Kristi Noem. She's the South Dakota dog killing governor. She is going to be Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. I'll tell you, folks, this is like some kind of fever dream here, where, you know, you ever have the kind of dream where something really bad has happened and you wake up and you start to realize, wait, this didn't really happen. I can undo it. I can go back, you know, and you do. You wake up and that didn't happen. I have been trying to do this for a week now, almost a week, and it's not working. It's not working at all. And I realize this is our reality right now. And it's been tough. It's been tough. And I'm sure most anybody would agree with that, regardless of what side you are on. And it takes time to recover from things like this. But I am impressed with the professionalism and speed with which the losing side acknowledged that they lost and came to terms, well, are coming to terms with it. There's some issues. But if there's one thing I'm a little bit relieved at, is that there's not going to be insurrection in the streets over the election itself. Now, there's 4 years of unpredictability and quite probable hell ahead of us. And I don't know what kind of reaction that is going to inspire. But I do know that had Harris won, whether by a little or a lot, there would have been people that refused to accept it. And it would have gotten ugly again. Now, that's no reason to say, yeah, I'm glad they won. They got what they wanted, so they'll leave us alone now. No, that's basically bowing down to a bully. And we should never do that. But it's showing that you have integrity. You can admit when you lost. And now, the question is, what's next? What do you do? Well, one thing you don't do, in my eyes, is try and cast blame. Because, oh my God, have you seen lately all the different people who are being blamed for this?
No, because I've been not consuming media deliberately because of how cringy all of that is.
Yeah, me too.
It's really pathetic. Like, just take the L, go do something else.
Take the L? You mean
the loss.
Oh, I thought you meant the L train.
Well, you could take the L, too.
Why would I go to Canarsie?
It might get you somewhere.
Yeah, would Canarsie ever get you? Or the 14th Street? Never mind.
But having an opinion on it, like, it's just not going to fix anything. I don't know. And it tries to make a complex thing. This has been said on Late Night, but tries to make a complex thing really simple, and it just isn't.
Look, there is one reason why Kamala Harris lost. And I don't think it's her fault. I don't think it's the Democratic Party's fault. I don't think it's the fault of any one particular group of people. I think it's the fault of the people who didn't vote for her. Period. This is on you. You made the decision. Whether you didn't show up at all, or whether you showed up and pulled the lever or filled in the bubble for the other guy. You made that choice. This is on you. You will have to account for this and everything that happens in the future. You know, and I hope I'm wrong that it won't be a living hell for so many people. But all the evidence was out there. All the warnings were out there. You chose to ignore that. You chose something else. You believed you knew better than all of these people who knew Donald Trump, first time I said his name, for years, who worked with him, last time he was president. And those warnings did not resonate. And you felt that he could somehow come back and not do what he did the first time. And on that note, there's a lot of fiction going on about what he did the first time, about how great everything was. Look, go back, listen to these shows. It was not great. It was bad. It wasn't fun.
First of all, let's admit this is going to be 4 years of him playing golf, because that's exactly what it was.
It's going to be 4 years of him getting revenge. He is mad, and these people are always mad. They never stop being mad. So, yeah, that and there'll be some golf, too. He'll definitely be playing a lot of that.
I'm just saying, you don't think there... I guess adding to our memory that there was a lot of golf in between whatever else happened. But it is... I'm not really... I think this is going to be fun.
And that's the right attitude.
Because, like, let's just... Like, if you calm down a little bit and you understand, like, okay, they won. Like, let's see what they improve. And all those voters that voted thinking they're going to get something out of this, I sure hope that, you know, they deliver so that those people aren't upset.
Everything that happens from this point. On the world stage, domestically, policy-wise, it's all on them now. The Democrats can relax and just sit back and watch the show. Now, I'm not saying don't do other things to help save the country from devastation, but you don't have responsibility for this. That's all on them and the people who voted for them. And right. People who voted for them by not showing up or participating.
Yeah, and my argument has never been that, like, it's this endeavor isn't embarrassing. Like, America is,
oh God, it's so
wildly
embarrassing.
Wildly embarrassing. It's embarrassing to try to explain things when people talk to you about this country and you know, don't quite understand why things happen and occur. And I'm convinced though that this has a potential, I'd love to be wrong, to be more embarrassing path.
We're saying that a lot. We'd love to be wrong, but I don't think we will be. But okay, I might have a way of outlining it. So,
but just because it's embarrassing, more embarrassing, doesn't mean it isn't going to be fun. For me.
Yeah, you can make it fun, but the point is, and it's a very serious thing. But how did it happen? How do you explain yourself to people in other parts of the world? Try to look at it this way, okay? We have television in this country. Well, actually, you probably have it in your country, too. But let's think for now of the major broadcast networks, CBS, NBC, ABC, Fox, all right? Pick a night. Pick tonight. Whatever night you want to pick. And look at what's on in prime time. Now, starting at, like, 8 o'clock, going on to 11, what word that you could use on the radio, Kyle, would you use to describe all of that programming on the four major networks from 8 to 11 on a typical night? What word might you use? And again, FCC, be careful.
Shallow, artificial, vapid.
Many words. Okay. Yeah, I would say crap. I would say garbage.
Diluted. Diluted.
These are not accolades. We're not praising. Now, that, in a way, is also an election, because the programs that are on are the programs with the highest ratings, the programs that people want to see. Now, when you transfer that to a presidential election, what do people want to see? They want to see a show. They want to see the guy who did the crap on TV. And that's why you have choices that you can't possibly justify, or logic defeats you very, very quickly. I had this conversation the other day with someone else who owns a small business, and turns out they voted for Trump. And, you know, I it was civil, and in most cases it is totally civil, because most of the time people who do this kind of thing are very nice people. You know, the jerks, and the jerks on all sides, they're relatively few and far between. And unfortunately, they get all the headlines. But in this particular case, somebody I've talked to many, many times, voted for Trump. Why do you think? Well, I was in better shape financially. You know, I had money in the bank. And, you know, I just don't feel like, you know, the other side would have done that. Like, money in the bank. So, that was because of the Paycheck Protection Program, PPP. You remember that? Because of COVID, the COVID pandemic. Small businesses got two checks, generally, that covered their paychecks, and many of them just didn't pay people and had a little stockpile. That happened a lot. But COVID was a really, really bad thing, and we don't seem to remember that. I have a copy of the New York Times that lists 100,000 people who died on the front page. And the horror of that reality, it would eventually be 1 million, 10 times that. Now, you bring that up, oh, you can't blame Trump for COVID. No, of course not. But you can blame Trump for his poor reaction to COVID, which it's been estimated about 300,000 deaths could have been prevented with better reactions. Now, there are other reactions to the COVID crisis. Here in New York, for instance, I still to this day say that Cuomo did as good a job as he could have done with the knowledge that he had. But history somehow repaints things so that Trump doesn't get the blame and Democrats do for COVID, even though they were the ones being proactive and doing something about it, whereas Trump tried to play it off as nothing more than the flu. And this PPP program, actually that's the last P stands for program, that wasn't Trump's idea. He signed it into law, but it came from Congress. It was introduced by a Democrat.
Yeah, that was a congressional maneuver.
You're better off because you had money, but it was because of a pandemic that you had money in the first place. It was a complete catastrophe. Now, you blame Biden for inflation. Inflation is a worldwide phenomenon, and it came about as a result of what happened with COVID. But no, Biden gets blamed for that. Trump doesn't get blamed for COVID. The conversation went on. But basically, you know, I got them to admit, yeah, I don't like Trump. I think he's a terrible person, but I think he'll do a better job. It's like, well, don't you think you should give Harris the same choice? Oh, no, I don't like her. Okay, so it does matter when it's Kamala Harris and you don't like her for some reason, but you can totally detest Donald Trump, and yeah, let's let him back in, see what he can do. So there's this something in the air that just makes people suckers, and they just want to follow, and I don't know, maybe they just want to see how bad things can possibly get too. There's an element of that, but it's sad, and that is what I'm seeing in many, many places. People saying, yeah, you know, we're better off. We weren't better off. This is history rewriting itself. Now, okay, then we get to finger pointing, and there's so much of that going on. Oh, my God. You know what? I've got a little email sent out by the guy I just mentioned, ex-governor Andrew Cuomo. He's been pissed off now for a while because, you know, he got kicked out of office and, yeah, and he's getting bitter. And, you know, this kind of thing, it happens with Democrats and with people on the so-called left. Which, by the way, this so-called left, in most places, would be straight down the middle. It would not be on the left at all. People have been called socialist, radical, communist. They have never met anybody who fits that definition. I guarantee it. They would faint if they did. The policies, you know, the ideas... No, that's not what the Democratic Party is. They are almost as far to the right as Republicans.
It's calling vanilla spicy.
And some people do. Yeah. We'll pursue that.
It's so vanilla. I mean, come on. I mean, it's the assailing critiques of what people are. It's laughable because people are just living their lives. They're not the caricatures you want to draw of them and scapegoat. And I applaud the imagination, but that's about it.
Well, anyway, so he's being a bit snarky here, saying Trump wins. Ouch. How did the Democrats lose to Donald Trump? The man they mocked and ridiculed as an evil charlatan, a fascist, a felon. How embarrassing. I already don't like where this is going. That question will first lead the Democrats to finger-pointing, but ultimately they must look in the mirror because Trump didn't win, the Democrats lost. So he's basically pointing the finger at everybody. Okay, so top 10 reasons. A terrible beginning, the Biden deception. For months, top Democratic leaders exited the White House after meeting with President Biden, purposely extolling his health, vigor, and mental acuity. And then the American people saw him at the first debate and were shocked at his condition and realized the ongoing Democratic deception. Okay, nice phrase there, but it's possible for somebody to be old and also, you know, completely with it as far as being able to make decisions and understand situations. Might not be able to, you know, run the New York City Marathon, but and he had a bad night that night. Absolutely, everybody admitted that. But it was late, you know, when you get up at 5 or 6 in the morning and you're 80, I guess you get a little tired at 9 o'clock. But anyway, you know, that wasn't enough. And again, Republican talking point here. Forcing Biden out of office appeared to be a palace coup. So what do you want? You don't want him in office. You don't want him out of office. And now you're saying it's a coup, which is what the Republicans say. I see this all the time from Democrats, you know, where they say, oh, the Democrats lost because they embraced all this far left. What far left are you talking about? Were people's homes being divided up and spread amongst the populace? You know, Lenin style. What exactly was far left about any policy that Democrats had? You know, I ask people this, and they come up with these fantasy things about, well, I don't want men playing in girls' sports. When did that even become an issue? It became an issue because Republicans made it this issue when it's not even something that is. First of all, they are not men. Okay, they are transition females. And you call the team a girls' team, but you call the transition person a man. You don't even realize how offensive that is, and how ignorant it is, and how uncommon it is for that to even make a difference. Talk to the people on the teams, although it's probably too creepy for you to even do that. How about you just stop talking about it, period, because it's none of your damn business. You know, let them work it out. Let the girls' teams, meaning the girls, work it out. Instead, it became a political issue, and the Democrats couldn't really defend it because it's not really their issue. It's not really something they were pushing, yet somehow it got labeled as such. Okay, there's more here about the economy, and yeah, we talked about this. The economy is the economy everywhere. Go to Canada, go to the UK, go to Germany. Inflation is ever-present. And the United States is actually doing better than those other countries. Guess what? Come January, Trump will take credit for that. Yeah. Even though it's impossible for change to happen that quickly, he'll inherit a pretty good economy, and he'll say, yeah, I did that. Okay, here we go. The progressive position of the Democratic Party was distorted by minority far-left extremist views on, you ready, defunding the police. Okay, what candidate said that? Legalizing prostitution. I don't know where that came from, but I didn't hear anybody mentioning that either. I mean, we can talk about that, but I didn't see that as a campaign issue on any Democrat's platform. Open borders. Another thing, the borders are open, really? Because pretty sure there's border control, patrol, there's, you know, barriers and things like that. Wide open border. You can say it's not hard to get into this country, but to say wide open borders enough times, people start repeating it and making it reality.
It's by design, though. I mean, it's an incredibly lengthy border, and it was completely, like open and, like, understood that segments of our southern border were something that was beyond the ability of our system to build something.
Nobody opened
the whole wall thing. Never happened.
Nobody opened the border and said, everybody come in. But that is how they portrayed it, and it worked. And now you have Andrew Cuomo saying that. Sex education in schools. What, that's a problem now? You can't have sex education? I had sex education in school. All right, that was not a big deal, but now apparently even for Democrats that's a big deal. The cultural arrogance and elitism of the Democratic Party, quoting Cuomo here, was epitomized by the woke culture, and here we go, blaming the woke culture for everything, as if that is some kind of boogeyman that's going to destroy everybody, and they can't even define their terms. So they'll come up with what I just mentioned here, you know, these issues that are not issues on the Democratic side. Issues the Republicans foist onto them to make it as if they are doing this, and people believe it and say, wow, we have to stop the Democrats who aren't even saying this. Yeah, you know, everything else in this Andrew Cuomo email, it's like you're reading a press release from a Republican.
That stuff really bothers me because I don't really think there's that much being taught. The sex education stuff, and I think in the political sphere, I mean, the transgender and other issues, like anything that has any kind of taboo or touches on that at all, we're just incapable in the general sphere to have a nuanced conversation about it, and people have different approaches and different ways of thinking about that kind of stuff, and it is indeed personal. You have to have an environment where you can have open conversation that isn't going to devolve, and that's not what we're doing right now in the political realm. So to me, trying to solve that or like come to some conclusion, that's a pet issue. That's more like something you identify with in the opposition, I guess, in this case, that you're trying to get other Democrats to warm up to, which I, in an attempt to like, again, say, oh, we're centrist, we're not far left. I'm again going to say this is vanilla being spicy to us, because I got to tell you, there is nil in the culture for, like, I'll say, like, LGBTQ. That is so relegated, and in my opinion, such an embarrassment, such a shame, what we do to it in our society. And then to now embroil transgender people, it is so incredibly insensitive to, and just hilariously like inaccurate to talk about like how diminished and how hidden and how backwards our attitudes are towards those communities. They're relegated to apps, to speakeasies, and, you know, bars few and far between. It's not widely seen in the media, other than being a token or some kind of caricature or exaggeration or stereotype of a specific community. And that, now you don't even know what segment of people I'm talking about anymore, because it applies to so many more. Well, so it's for us to sit here and act like what we talk about in the media and what we talk about in the political realm is so edgy and so out there. It isn't. It isn't. It's pathetic. It's so cloistered. It's like third grade level. We got kid gloves on everything. It's a joke.
So everything you said except for the last part basically sounds like something that would be said by a Democrat while they were running. We all have different points of view. It's a big tent. We have to be considerate of each other's backgrounds and unique situations. But just by saying that, you become a proponent of their worst nightmare, which is migrants crawling over the border and people having sex change operations in elementary school and whatever else they choose to make up. They are able to convince their followers that this is reality when it's nowhere close to reality. And how do you fight that? You know, it's really, I think it's almost impossible. I don't think they could have done better as far as trying to reach out to everybody. You know, case in point, with the finger pointing, people who are pro-Palestinian, especially in the Midwest, saying, yeah, we didn't vote for you because you weren't doing enough to stop the genocide in the Middle East, in Gaza. And that may be true. In fact, it is true. Not enough is being done to stop it. But what is the political reality? Because if Kamala Harris had said, you know what, I agree with you, Netanyahu's got to go, this guy's a maniac, what he's doing is unconscionable, well, then you lose the pro-Jewish vote or the pro-Israeli vote. And I've already heard from people saying, yeah, you know, I'm pro-Israel. She wasn't pro-Israel enough, so I didn't vote for her. So how do you get past that? How do you possibly speak to both groups and try to be fair? It's just not possible. And both groups won't vote for you. And instead, you embrace the guy that is going to make things so much worse. There'll be no two-state solution, I guarantee you that. And anti-Semitism is going to find a new home here.
Don't come crying to me.
I feel the same way. I mean, look, you have to think big picture. You have to think, okay, it might not be exactly what I want, but is it better than the alternative? And if you can't make that decision, I don't know if you understand what voting is. Because letting the evil guy in that is going to basically do horrible things by his own words, that just does not seem smart by any stretch of the imagination. Hey, I want to leave on a positive note. And the positive note is that, sad as we might be, confused as we might be, just know the other side is confused, angry, and bitter, too, even though they won. I get emails from everybody. But basically, yeah, with Donald Trump winning the White House, Republicans winning the U.S. Senate, party expect to hold the House of Representatives, you'd think they'd be happy. excuse me. Now is the time to act. Because the Republican-controlled Senate is in danger of falling victim to another attack by rhinos, Republicans in name only. So now they're starting a purge of the Republicans who aren't MAGA enough, and they're going to be hunting them down. Yeah, good luck with that. That's going to be fun. We'll watch from the sidelines. And this happened just today, I believe. Hear the country music singer Tim McGraw. Tim McGraw never endorsed a candidate in the recent election, but he did speak out on behalf of women's rights. And his daughter, well, she had opinions of her own about how bad Donald Trump was. And now as a result of that, Tim McGraw is a target of MAGA by having a daughter who had an opinion. Tim McGraw, since you like Democrats so much, may one of your kids' sex get changed at school without you knowing about it. One person wrote to him on Twitter, I've got a red pill for you after that. Another person said, stop spewing political crap. It's unbecoming. Again, he hasn't tweeted in months. Hey, Liberace, another wrote, how are those face fillers doing, fella? Do you know your wife looks like Gloria Vanderbilt? Did you get a two-for-one special with the Botox and the lifts? You're a piece for work, dude. Too bad you raised an abortion-loving garbage-mouth daughter. Not surprised coming from you slamming gun owners for wanting to protect themselves when you have armed security. You're a typical hypocrite liberal.
Oh.
So, buckle up, everybody. Buckle up. It's only just beginning.
Hey now, big dog. Come on.
This is how they treat people who haven't that even said a word.
That doesn't sound like America.
Not at all.
Easy there. Watch what you say.
OTW@2600.com. It's our email address. We have a lot ahead of us. Looking forward to it. Hope you are, too. Stay tuned, WUSB.
It's going to be fun.
Good night.
If I could see you,
You are listening to the Struggle Session on WUSB Stony Brook. Marxism-Leninism in the 21st Century, Baby. Let's go.